Welcome back, fellow paranormal aficionados. This is Haunted 518, and we're going to get right into it today. I'm especially excited for this episode because this is where I currently live. So I've been wanting to do this for a while, and I wasn't sure if there was enough to talk about, and sure enough, I found a lot to talk about. So first and foremost, let's go ahead and get my drink cracked. So I am drinking something that was gifted to me by a past guest from Brooklyn Brewery. It's called Bodega Run, and it's a well-stocked IPA, whatever that means. It's interesting. It's definitely like fruity and feels like a hearty IPA. It says Sabro and Mandarina hops, soft oats and wheat, and a silky finish. Strawberry, creamy, and bountiful. Oh, it's the strawberries. I was like, I definitely tasted fruity. I like that. It's interesting. It's like a cross between an IPA and a wheat beer. I haven't had one like that. And it has a whopping 6.7% alcohol, so that's always great. And the art on the can, very bright and colorful. I love it. So definitely recommend. So, like I said, I'm particularly excited for today. We're going to take a little trip because I didn't necessarily find enough in each of these places, and they were all close enough, so we're going to take a little road trip. We're going to start in Malta and Stillwater area, which is basically where I live right now. Then we'll move on to Mechanicville. I'm technically in the town of Stillwater. My address is Mechanicville, but I live the closest to Malta. So it's a weird little area. So we'll start in Malta, Mechanicville, Stillwater area. And then I figured we would actually pop over to Scaticoke because it's just up and over. And there were just a few little things I wanted to talk about. And then we're going to head down to Waterford because it's close enough and we've already done Watervliet, which if you haven't listened to that episode, that still is, in my opinion, one of my not best episodes but favorite episodes, because the story that I tell in that is just sinister and bone chilling, and it's a story that when I heard it and I learned who this person was a couple years ago that was telling it, pretty great person in the paranormal community, I just couldn't believe that had happened. And so I think that's one of my first 10, and it's in within the first 20 episodes I ever did a couple of years ago. So definitely head back and check out Watervliet if you haven't. But today we're going to round it off with Waterford. So we're going to start in Malta. A little just history. During the 1760s, settlers gathered at Maltaville near Round Lake along Dunning Street and on the town's western border. Local soil was ideal for farming, and the major routes between Albany and the North Country passed through or near the town. The militia parade ground stood in the town center, offering a training site for these pioneers in all of the nation's wars. Round Lake and Saratoga Lake offered prime fishing spots, as they still do today. So the first place in Malta we're going to talk about is the Weed House. David Weed, a resident of the town in the early 1800s, built a small house and barn on the heights southwest of Saratoga Lake, where Kramer Road lies today. Farm life was hard for Weed, his wife, and the two sons they raised. Winters were cold and illnesses took their toll. In the 1830s, one of the boys died. Shortly after, his wife Louisa expired, leaving Weed heartbroken and perhaps feeling that fate had not given him a break. He deeded the farm to Fanny Brown, a daughter-in-law, and left Saratoga County to seek his fortune near Oswego in northern New York State. He began a new life, remarried, and fathered more children. Farming dictated endless chores, and they were not Fanny's cup of tea. By the early 1850s, she decided to sell her property. The legal system of that time stipulated that she have a male legal guardian appointed to conduct the legal business of the sale. The court assigned a Mr. Anderson to fill that role, and he apparently took the task to heart. He negotiated a fair sale price, permitting Fanny to resume her life elsewhere. Some think that Anderson, after his death, stayed on at the house, in spirit, if not in body. By now, the reader should recognize the typical symptoms of a haunting. Cold drafts, objects seemingly misplaced, strange noises at night, and vague movements seen from the corner of one's eye. In an old farmhouse, this kind of activity never threatened the residents who came after Fanny. Only in the present century did Anderson, or whoever it is, change his behaviors, perhaps adapting to modern times. Recently, a family sat relaxing on the sun porch of the old weed house on a balmy afternoon. Suddenly, there came a loud crash from the kitchen. Everyone rushed into the room to discover a disaster of some sort, and nothing was visible. No broken windows, plates, glasses, nothing. On another occasion, the daughter of the family twice heard a male voice call her name. The first time she believed it to be her father, and as her daughters will, she just ignored it. A second time she heard her name called, this time more insistently. "What?" she inquired. No response came for a minute, and then she did hear her voice saying, "Did you hear that too?" On another day, the son's car was parked, and it had, as it had been for a month, on the level part of the driveway. It wouldn't run and needed repairs. The mother went out onto the porch to hang clothes on the clothesline and noted that the car had somehow moved almost half the way, maybe 25 feet along the length of the driveway. How can a car do that on a flat surface unless someone or something pushes it? The youngsters had been in school all day. Was Tom Anderson, as they referred to the presence, busy again? Another morning, half awake and half asleep, the daughter heard a male voice say to her, "Lillian, it's time to get up." So she arose, a bit miffed that her dad was trying to control her too much. Then as she passed his bedroom, she saw him still asleep in his bed. Anderson not only helps family members attend their schedules, he sometimes has helped them avoid injury. Lillian went to sleep one night, forgetting she had raised the inner window and the storm window a bit to cool the room. Because the window shade was pulled, the situation wasn't evident. She drifted peacefully asleep under her cozy electric blanket, hoping that the snow falling outside the window would close school the next day. In the middle of the night, her window shade suddenly shot up, making a terrible racket that awoke her. As she grumbled at having to pull the shade again, she jolted awake. Blowing snow had come underneath the windows and shade and had melted all over the electric blanket. Had Tom not been on the job, she might have been electrocuted. As with so many quiet rural houses, the old weed house shelters people, but it also shelters unseen forces. Seldom are they scary, like the steadfast tin soldier of fiction. Tom Anderson still seems to watch out for the women who live there. Next, we're going to move on to William Marvin's Tavern. The hamlet of East Lyne was a prosperous community with stores and churches in close proximity to the farm families they served. Along East Lyne Road, there were both farms and merchants. William Marvin had a tavern there, likely built in the early 1830s. Over the years, as people moved away from East Lyne, lured to bigger villages or cities, or making a living at something easier than farm life, the building became a house. It passed through many hands until Lawrence's grandfather bought it around 1940, and Lawrence grew up there. One night in the 1960s, one of his friends stayed overnight. The two boys chatted for a while, and then the friend drifted off to sleep. Lawrence, too, was on the borderline between waking and sleeping when he heard a man laughing boisterously. He knew for sure that there was no other man in the house. Thinking it could be some trick of acoustics and that the friend had made the noise, Lawrence looked over at his friend's bed, only to see him fast asleep. A nice feature in the house was an old upright piano in the living room downstairs. Perhaps the room had known another piano in the old days. One night, the two lads were picking out chopsticks or another such duet when they felt a huge presence move directly behind them. Just a slight movement of air was felt, but the music seemed to reverberate off a surface just behind them. The equivalent of whistling in the dark, they continued to play, determined not to let their imaginations play tricks on them. For a while, the presence seemed to leave, and when they started their next selection, it came back. It was almost as if their backs tingled from the proximity to something, but nothing was visible. So both of them jumped up. In unison, they said to one another, "Did you see that? Did you feel that?" And then they ran outdoors. After that, Lawrence never felt at ease there, and soon afterward he had the opportunity to move away, and he did so. Though the property was willed to him in the years later years, he sometimes visits the place. He never goes into the old house. Too many of Marvin's old cronies are still hanging out there. And the next one is the Ghost House of East Lyne. In the 1890s, Marvin's Tavern probably had already been converted to a house. There's no record of people in that time noting a ghostly presence there. However, that was not the case just down the road. The small hamlet of East Lyne flourished at the intersection of Route 67 and East Lyne Road and consisted of several churches, a store, and a hotel, as well as other now forgotten structures. Settlers and businessmen had been coming to the junction since 1786. The Boston Journal of October 26, 1895 carried a curious story from that small community recounting a great fire that had taken place the previous Saturday evening. A store and a home at the corners had burned down. 45 mile per hour winds had fanned the flames, making them impossible to extinguish. John Oliver's wife and daughter, who lived right next to the conflagration, managed to escape. The story continued with the information that an old abandoned dwelling called the Haunted House on the opposite side of the road did not catch fire. It noted, "His ghostship was not disturbed. Who owned the house and the nature of the haunting has been lost over time. The building seems to have remained for some years before progress tore it down. Today, a bright and attractive sign stands at the spot, welcoming strangers to the town of Malta, and one wants to add, and to its ghostly past." The next one is called The Pit. To the southwest of East Lyne on County Route 80 stands an old farmhouse of uncertain age. Amid the newer homes of commuters, it stands out because of its architecture and size. Many families have called this old house home. The present owner's husband died there in 1981, leaving her with a large home to manage. To supplement her income, she decided to modernize and rent a section of the house, and that meant hiring a contractor who would do it right. An old part of the building was stripped down to the farming timbers in order to bring plumbing and electrical wiring up to modern quality. The contractor then began erecting a large stringer beams across the roof space and planned to support the center of these timbers with a strong post. Before the post could be installed, they needed to dig a hole for concrete footing in the soil and then build the new floor to surround it. The weather was cold and the wind whipped through the framework. Before too many shovels full of dirt were excavated, the workmen noted a strange occurrence. Soil seemed to be gently sifting downward in the middle of their footing hole, as if it were falling into an underground cavity. As they watched, the hole became larger, perhaps a foot across. They had no flashlight with them with which to penetrate the subterranean darkness, so the boss took a long metal rod from his truck and began to probe the depths of the pit. When withdrawn, the rod had pieces of oak wood clinging to it. One side of the pieces appeared to have been plain smooth at one time. What was this? Each began to offer an opinion. Perhaps it was a treasure chest, since this had once been the house of a prosperous family. Maybe a coffin? Didn't they make coffins out of oak in the old days? Quickly, the cold weather caused them to break off speculation. Time is money in the construction business, and this delay was costing them income. The contractor had an easy answer. They would need concrete for the footing, so why not call the concrete ready mix truck right then? So he did. The great vat at the rear of the truck disgorged cubic foot after cubic yard of concrete into the hole. Eventually, it topped off and the depression was filled. A new footing for the post was poured inside a wooden form and the truck departed. The construction crew went back to nailing plywood sheets onto the walls. They wanted the building enclosed by the time the owner returned from work. She came home and just as the men were packing up their tools for the day. The contractor matter-of-factly told the owner about the delay occasioned by the pit and how they had solved the matter. She was horrified. "What if that was an old grave that you guys dug into? Didn't you want to know?" Without a word, the contractor handed her a pointed shovel and said, "It's all yours, lady. If you want to know badly enough, you dig it up." Choosing discretion as the better part of valor, she dropped the shovel and went inside. Within a month, the addition was finished. A bright and modern, comfortable rental apartment was ready for its first tenant. However, she has had a difficult time keeping tenants for long in that part of the building. Some have reported to her that doors doors flew open without any reason, and one tenant saw a little old man strolling through the apartment and out through the door. She had tried to coexist with the specter, naming him Grandpa Henry, but eventually decided it was more prudent to find a new place to live. Eventually, the owner hopes to find a tenant that isn't so fussy, and some people can live in haunted spaces for years and never be aware of others. So let's hope she finds one of those. So next we are going to move on to Mechanicville, to the city of Mechanicville. And let's go ahead and start with this little bit of history. Located on the Hudson River, Mechanicville is Saratoga County's second city. Once upon a time, Iroquois war trails crossed the spot. The white man came to this spot and crisscrossed it with rails of steel. As a city of mills, Mechanicville became a large classification yard for the Delaware and Hudson and Boston and Maine railroads. Oil barges and pleasure boats alike make use of the locks of the barge canal along the river. Colonel Elmer Ellsworth, an early hero of the Civil War, is buried there. I didn't know that. The first one is the church, and I wonder if it's the big church. It is a looming large church in Mechanicville. Built in the early 1880s, its belfry tower rises over the buildings of the cities. The solid architecture is evidence of strong faith that inspired natives and immigrants alike during the golden age of the industry. The church stands where a tavern stood in colonial times. In those days, there was a small spring or watering trough in the front of the tavern for travelers to slake the thirst of their horses. The building's owners had some royalist leanings, but it was smart enough not to speak out against the revolution when it began. He did, however, forbid continental soldiers to enter his establishment, which must have led to some angry confrontations on that spot. The construction of the church in later years brought peace to a troubled location, and maybe the elders found some satisfaction in erecting a house of God in a place where men had often drunk to excess. A sensitive layman guided me through the building one day. I love to take part in worship on Sundays, and even more, I love choir practice, although I don't like to be here by myself. I pick up feelings and energies that others are oblivious to, he said. A soft crimson carpet absorbed his words, and both of us would have enjoyed sitting in the reflected afternoon sun as it illuminated the golden oak woodwork. But this was a tour, and I wanted to see as much as possible in order to comprehend the occasional phenomena there. My guide told of an old friend named Robert, an intelligent and immensely gifted man who was the church organist after World War II. He gave organ lessons in the church and had finished his instruction late one afternoon. His student had left sometime earlier by a rear door. Robert crossed the church behind the last pews and came forward to make a left turn through solid swinging doors that led into the south foyer. As he approached the doors, he told my guide, he noticed them swinging gently as if someone had just passed through them. He stood there trying to figure out how that was possible when he knew he was alone in the church. Suddenly, the doors opened with a bang and he was enveloped by a frigid gust of air that swirled around and around him for several minutes. Then, as quick as it came, it left. The doors closed and the organist was alone. Robert was overwhelmed and went through the foyer and a door into the pastor's apartment. The pastor, after hearing the details, called his superior. Bishop Oxnam came up from Troy, as Robert understood he had on other occasions, and performed an exorcism and blessing of the building, and that seemed to settle it. On a Thursday night in the late 1980s, the church choir gathered for the weekly rehearsal. Members are accustomed to entering the church through a rear door, leading it into the assembly hall. A spacious multi-purpose room just off the sanctuary, the choir gathered in the chancellor choir stalls and the practice began. Hardly had they started when the pastor and then one or two others noticed something odd. A stranger had entered the church from the assembly hall doorway, proceeded halfway down the aisle, and sat in a pew on his right. Spectators never came to choir practice. The slender man of sallow complexion sat there in rapt attention. The pastor, who knew all congregation members and even some of the old-timers, was mystified. He was itching to go down to the pew and discover the man's identity as soon as the rehearsal finished. When the choir director dismissed the members, the visitor stood quickly and retraced his steps into into the assembly hall. We were no more than 3 steps behind him, but when we got to the hall doorway, the room was empty. We examined all the small rooms besides the hall, even searched the upstairs, but no one was there. How could he simply vanish? And why? Asked my guide. The mysterious stranger was never identified, and as the years went by, nobody talked of the incident because it couldn't be explained. Was this a former pastor or choir director's spirit looking in on a beloved spot from his lifetime, or is this a tourist from the spirit world drawn to the choir making heavenly music? So that's pretty interesting. And next, we are going to go to some personal stories from Mechanicville. And the first one is submitted by Jewel. Me and my friend were doing gymnastics in my living room. Then a little while later, we heard little girls giggling in my bathroom. We got spooked and then thought it was nothing. Then we heard banging downstairs and got scared. We sat on my couch for 2 hours and listened. We heard faint giggling for a little while. Then we saw a really faint little girl walk past. We felt that we were just seeing things. Then we heard footsteps and we didn't know what to do. That's terrifying. The next one is submitted by Emily. I live here in Mechanicville. I believe there are ghosts here. I have had 2 sightings. I was in my dad's backyard with 2 friends recently, about 2 summers ago, when we heard a lady yelling a boy's name. We looked around, and out of the basement door ran a little boy and a woman. They were both pale, almost white. We all screamed and ran when we heard the loud screech and saw the headlights flash through the basement window, and then we heard a loud scream, and that was it. We all left, but eventually went back. My second sighting wasn't as scary, but had more witnesses. I was across the street from my friend's house with 7 of my friends. We were waiting for our 8th friend to come outside when we heard someone banging on the window. We looked across the street to see if it was our friend when we saw a pale, angry old man in the attic window. He was banging and looked very mad. Then he just suddenly bawled into a cloud and floated away from the window. We all screamed and ran. And not to mention, it was very dark out. So that's really super creepy. And next we're going to move on to Stillwater. So Stillwater, we have the most notorious location in Stillwater, which we'll get into. I'm going to tell you a little bit of history first. So the town of Stillwater. Indian trade routes and war paths ran through the town before white soldiers arrived to prosecute the French and Indian War and American Revolution. The greater part of Saratoga Battlefield lies within Stillwater, yet the official name of the place of the battle is the old Indian name, Saratoga, place of many waters. In 1791, the town was established, and in 1816, Stillwater Village was incorporated. The town history is that of our nation is in miniature. Transportation, land routes, and the Champlain Canal pierced the wilderness. Businesses, great and small, sprang up amid prosperous farms, and the people of the town are prepared to move into new century, treasuring their historic past more deeply than many modern Americans. So, of course, the most notable place is the Saratoga National Historic Park. It stands on the site of a major American victory over British forces in a battle that took place in September of 1777. The battlefield is open to the public, and visitors have reported seeing the ghosts of men in revolutionary garb. One incident involved a man in a 3-cornered hat who approached a woman and told her he believed his own men shot and killed him. After his story was complete, the man vanished, never to be seen again. And I can attest, I used to take my dog there to walk a lot, but it has since become an on-leash only place, or if it was off, never off leash, they never enforced it. So I did speak to a ranger last year, and unfortunately it's too tempting of a place for my dog to pull because it's just wide, beautiful open fields. But I spent a lot of time there walking him and letting him roam while I roamed. I even brought like a ghost spirit box app, and I heard some really interesting things coming through it. I heard a lot of like Native American reference words, and a lot of military reference words would always come through, and then a lot of first names. Who those people are, I'm not sure, but the place is very different energy-wise, and I know that a lot could be talked about. It definitely deserves its own episode. So if you haven't been there, especially if you're sensitive or empathic or anything like that, I really suggest that you take some time to go there. You can really just wander and get lost. You can also bike around through there. It's really beautiful. They have a paved biking area. So I definitely recommend it. And the view from the Welcome Center is really beautiful too, because it's set up a little bit higher. So the first story in Stillwater we're going to talk about is called The Travelers. It is likely that the story has been told of other places, but I am indebted to Bill Dixon, formerly of Malta Ridge in the town of Malta, for this version. Legend says that it took place in the town of Stillwater. A husband and wife arrived by train in Saratoga Springs quite a few years ago, probably before 1900. As their destination was somewhere near the present village of Stillwater, they hired a horse and carriage from a local livery. The skies appeared threatening, so they traveled fast, hoping to arrive at their destination without getting rained on. As they drove past Saratoga Lake, the sky grew almost as dark as night, and the wind began to blow strongly. Then the rain began to pelt them. Knowing that they needed to seek shelter quickly, they were gratified to see light shining from a weather-beaten house close by. Reining in their carriage at the door to the hovel, they knocked. The old farmer welcomed them in, saying, "You better be willing to stay the night, because the storm won't blow itself out until morning." They were shown into a plain but comfortable room, and the farmer volunteered to move their horse and carriage into the old barn. After a sound sleep, the couple awoke in the morning to find the house empty. Had the residents all gone away? In any case, there was no food in the house, so they prepared to move on to friends who were expecting them near Stillwater. Filled with gratitude for this haven during the night, the husband left a shiny silver dollar on a small table in the hallway as compensation for their lodging. The couple then drove to their destination, where the host expressed their worry that they had not arrived before the storm. The wife assured her host that they had been well cared for by the farmer near a bend in the road about 5 miles west. The host's eyes widened because they knew the precise spot to which the travelers were referring. "You couldn't have stayed there," they said. "That old farm burned to the ground years ago." As the travelers were certain about their experience, and as it was a nice day for a carriage ride, the group chose to retrace the travelers' route to see which story was right. When they came to the spot, all they found was an overgrown cellar hole filled with brambles. When they reached the edge of the old foundation, the group looked down. Amid the brushes, vines, and charred timbers that filled the depression, they saw a small table that was not burned, and on it, a tiny, shiny silver dollar. Wow. The next one is the battlefield. We're going to delve into it. The government of Great Britain, hoping to end the American Rebellion quickly in 1777, sent armies to capture strategic centers in the colonies. Burgoyne's invasion was aimed at Albany. As he proceeded south along the Hudson River, he had to pass beneath or over the tops of bluffs on the western side of the river. The colonial army under General Horatio Gates waited for him with forces that were reinforced weekly. While harsh travel conditions and illnesses took an ever-increasing toll on Burgoyne's force. On September 19th, a two-pronged British attack under Baron von Riedesel and General Simon Fraser clashed with the Americans at Freeman's Farm. It seemed the British were victorious. To their dismay, they couldn't pursue their advantage, so the first battle was inconclusive. It took almost another month for the two armies to engage full force on the afternoon of October 7th. During that battle, Fraser was killed and quickly buried in a fortification in British camp. Benedict Arnold led a wild charge, capturing another British redoubt, and the British army was forced to retrench. They never gained an advantage again, and Burgoyne had to sue for peace. On Friday, October 17th, he offered his sword and surrender to General Gates. The war moved elsewhere, and the battlefield became a curiosity. Occasionally, a local farmer claimed to see lights on the battlefield at night. Hunters or farmers who crossed the field sometimes heard shouts or other strange noises, but the heroic dead on both sides didn't get much recognition until the centennial of the battle. In 1877, monuments were erected to those who had struggled valiantly. Eventually, the battlefield came under the supervision of of the National Park Service. Friendly staff and park rangers, plus a wonderful visitor center, help bring the history of the place alive today. However, some stories cannot be told in the Interpretation Center. There seem to be ghosts at the battlefield. Military encampments are frequently held there, usually by American reenactors, but occasionally by British Army units. During a 1984 encampment with costumed soldiers and families milling about the site, a local woman had an unforgettable experience. Just after sunset, she saw lights moving along the tree line near the Balcarres Redoubt. Campers lost tourists? Her attention was drawn to one light that did not move. Was that Fraser's ghost? Modern excavations in the Great Redoubt, Fraser's burial site, have failed to turn up a body or even bones. Did the British later move the body to a now forgotten grave? A former ranger, consumed by this mystery, invited a psychic who knew nothing of the battle history to give a reading. Taking on what was purported to be Fraser's spirit, the woman said, "You can't find my body, the wolves got it." The rumor persists that Fraser's ghost roams the battlefield in search of the grave. Of course, locals love to embellish the story, and not so long ago, on the night of the battle anniversary, a passerby spotted green lights in the old British fortifications on the hill. Occasionally, there are sightings in the daylight, too. A few years ago, visitors stood at an overlook interpretation site at Freeman's Farm. As they oriented themselves to the map, they looked out on the peaceful field and saw a lone figure in a red uniform walk from the trees and onto the field where Von Reed Dassel's forces had once launched an attack. After some walking, the figure disappeared in the trees. The tourists complimented the rangers at the visitor center at the end of the tour. Costumed actors really enlivened our tour, they said, but the rangers informed the visitors that the battlefield's small operating budget did not provide for actors. In 1997, a battlefield visitor camped overnight in the American lines at Bemis Heights during an encampment. In the dark of the night, he heard galloping horses' hooves and the sound of wheels, heavy wheels, rolling along. Were these ghostly memories of the battle still playing themselves out? The other logical explanation would be that some unknown person would be silly enough to ride horses and drive wheeled vehicles through a pitch-dark encampment, not knowing where people were sleeping. Perhaps the strangest tale comes to me from a ranger who I'll call Jim. A few years ago, he and his partner were stationed about a half mile apart, facing west toward Route 32, which is the western perimeter of the battlefield. The state highway is a wonderful place for deer poachers to enter the battlefield, which has plenty of white-tailed deer. Hunting on a federal property is a criminal activity, so the two rangers sat in their patrol cars on a beautiful October afternoon to catch or scare off poachers. Located in the old Birtle Farm, which operated before being incorporated into government hands, Jim and his partner were enjoying the balmy afternoon, and they had their patrol car windows rolled down. The sun was shining and the changing leaves were beautiful. The old historic Nielsen farmhouse blocked the two men's view of one another, but they had radio contact if they needed it. Then the peaceful autumn scene was interrupted by something that Jim can still not understand. He began to hear voices. At first, the voices were vague and unintelligible. Moans and groans were heard. Then he distinctly heard an insistent voice say, "Come here." He sat up and turned to see who had come near the patrol car, but no one was there. Still, the murmur of voices continued, and he heard one cry out, help me, please. Again, he craned his neck to see who and where the troubled person was. He could see over half a mile in all directions, and not another living soul was in sight. The volume of the murmuring seemed to increase, and then he heard a pained voice cry out, "Oh no, not the arm." Probably the National Park Service Handbook for Rangers does not contain a protocol for this experience. What to do? The noises continued for almost 45 minutes and then subsided. The fields were silent once more. For a while, he sat there trying to make sense out of an impossible experience. When the shift was just about over and the battlefield neared its closing time, and because no poachers showed up that day, Jim put in a radio to call to his partner. The two agreed to rendezvous at a certain road intersection on their way back to headquarters. When he reached the place, his partner pulled up and he said his and he had the first word. Jim, you wouldn't believe what I just experienced. It was like a big party going on all around my car. I heard people talking and there was nobody there, he told him. Jim answered, come on, buddy. Let's get back to the headquarters and see if we can make any sense out of all of this. In the next few days, they began to put the pieces together. There was an old barn on the Bertle farm. Either it had been there at the time of the battle, unlikely, or it was built on the site of an older barn that the American Army has used as a field hospital. Surgery of wounded limbs certainly would have been done there. Weren't they very close to the battle anniversary? And then they heard about Joe and Diane. The man and woman were regular battlefield visitors from near Albany. They especially liked the natural beauty around the Bertle farm. When Jim met with them, they said that the old barn was like a ghostly loudspeaker. One could often hear moans and groans, and sometimes distinct disembodied voices in it. The two visitors considered it just a part of the battlefield experience. Thousands of men protecting the welfare of their retrospective countries struggled to the death on the fields overlooking the still waters of the Hudson. Some certainly were buried near where they fell, and the graves became forgotten after just a few short years. Fraser lost his life, and Timothy Murphy, the American scout who shot him, gained a reputation there. Benedict Arnold's reputation reached heroic proportions there before betraying his country at West Point. Countless German mercenaries from Hesse-Hanau, Hesse-Cassel, and Brunswick were demoralized there. Burgoyne suffered a temporary setback in his career, and Gates and artillery genius Kosciuszko were lionized. Violent death and shedding of blood combined at Saratoga to create both deep anguish and euphoria for a new nation. The ghosts of the past are making sure that the sacrifices of our ancestors on the field of Stillwater are not forgotten. So that is really fun to delve into some history, and I would be willing to bet that some of you have had experiences there. So please write in. The email is thehaunted518@gmail.com. Send us a DM on Instagram or reach out to me on our Facebook page, Haunted518's Facebook page. And next, we're going to head over to Waterford. So the town of Waterford, the British recognized the strategic importance of the land at the confluence of the Hudson and Mohawk rivers and fortified it in 1689. It was a strong supply center during the Revolution and continues to be an important site in New York State's canal system where the Champlain and Erie barge canals intersect. In 1804, the river was first crossed by a bridge in Waterford. History is preserved at New York State Historic and Nature's Park on Peebles Island and kept alive in a beautiful Greek Revival house called the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center. So the first one is the Carpenter's House. Around 1900, a poor carpenter, his wife, and children lived not far from Canal Lock Number 2. He had tuberculosis and found it difficult to work regular hours and support his family. When he became unable to work any longer, his greedy parents forced him to sign the house over to them, if he wanted his family to have shelter. According to legend, he warned his parents, if they harmed his family, he would haunt them as long as they lived. Soon after he died, the parents forced the widow and her children out of the house, hoping to rent it and enrich themselves. Dr. Lewis Jones, in The Things That Go Bump in the Night, notes that the house needed repairs if it was to attract tenants, so the parents closed and shuttered the building until they could afford the renovation. However, neighbors soon became frightened when they saw lights moving inside the closed house at night. The story of the carpenter's curse became widespread, and the ghostly activity continued each night. Prospective tenants were frightened away, and village residents took to walking on the opposite side of the street. The unrepaired house fell into worse condition and eventually fell into ruins. After that, no more lights were seen. True to his words, the carpenter prevented the avaricious parents from enjoying their ill-gotten gains. The next one is called the Furniture Movers. Behind St. Mary's Church in Waterford, there used to be a house in which renters stayed only for a short time. It may have been known as the Quigley House. Someone or something kept rearranging the furniture. Tenants usually left there in frustration or fear. Try as they might, renters could never keep their furnishings where they wanted them. When word got around, people just stopped trying to live there, and the building sat vacant for about 25 years before it was torn down. The demolition crew was surprised to find human bones underneath the debris of the house when they cleaned up the property. Maybe some former resident of the property had been murdered or disposed of in a clandestine manner. In the 1930s, another house was built, but on an opposite side of the building lot. When Dr. Jones recorded this story in Things That Go Bump in the Night, there had apparently not been any new ghosts, perhaps because the bones had been given a respectful burial. And next is the Munson House. In its heyday, Waterford was a community of thriving mills whose smoke drifted across the river into Rensselaer County. One of these mills was owned by a Mr. Munson, whose manager had disappeared sometime earlier in 1912. The mystery deepened when the manager's wife also was missing. Munson lived in a large frame house on the present site of St. Mary's Church. Gertrude Myers' mother, as a girl, used to dream of one day being mistress in the two-story house. Strolling home one evening, she saw a strange scenario playing out in the Munson house. A dormer window flew open and a woman wearing a white cap appeared and waved a long white cloth at a passerby. To the girl, it seemed she was also screaming or yelling, but the child couldn't be sure. The strange activity worried her and she hurried home. Over the dinner table, she told the strange story to her family members. They had reminded her that old Mr. Munson, a vexatious man, lived alone. He had become the sole proprietor of his mill since the disappearance of the partner, manager, and his wife. Her friends also told her that Munson was strongly anti-Christian. Others had heard him publicly vow that no Christian will ever get my property. The pastor of the old St. Mary's Church had often visited Munson, hoping to purchase his home as the site of a new church. Munson, according to the tale, cursed and swore that he would never sell to religious people. The more the neighbors heard the little girl's tale, the more they suspected that Munson had somehow conspired with or made off with his manager's wife. Perhaps he had even murdered the couple to gain wealth and control of the business. Some began to suspect the worst and suggested that the girl may have stumbled onto a crime, suggested by a ghost screaming to be released from the Munsons upstairs. The little girl thrilled to think that she had seen the ghost of a murdered woman. Suspicion was not enough for the police, and an investigation was never conducted. Apparently, the missing couple never reappeared. Munson soon ended everyone's speculation when he had a seizure and died, sometimes before 1920. Because there were no heirs, the executors of the estate put the house up for auction. Munson's spirit must have been exasperated, though it never showed up to register a complaint. When a Jewish family purchased the house at auction, did he know what they were going to do? The pastor from St. Mary's shortly worked out a deal and purchased the lot from the Jewish family. The old Munson house was demolished and a new church was erected on its site. In the 1940s, for a few years, neighbors claimed to see a shadowy figure standing alone on the sidewalk in front of the church, shaking his fist at all that entered. After that, all was quiet in Waterford. So that's funny. So the next one, I just wanted to just tell you before I told you a few personal stories. There was in 2021, I believe, there was the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center did a tour. There was a tour at the cemetery at night, and it was called Cemetery at Night Haunted History. It took place on October 20th, and you could tour the Waterford Rural Cemetery. You did not need to RSVP, and it was only $5 a person or $15 for a family of four. Explore some of the haunted history of Waterford. Tours led by the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center and Waterford Half Moon High School band students are historical and informative. If you've never been in a cemetery at night, that you'll find that you never know what else can pop up. The tours were about 30 to 45 minutes, and several were offered during the night. And so I just thought if that is still going on, that would be something really fun to do. So if you check the Waterford Historical Museum and Cultural Center, or maybe even just give them a call. And then next, there were some personal stories from Waterford that I wanted to talk about. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate, when I did that episode on Watervliet, one thing that I talked about was this story, obviously, that took place in Waterville, but within that story, the history of the area really, I just don't think I ever, even growing up around here, ever realized it was as kind of sinister as it is. So located right on the water, you know, these towns were hubs for basically nightlife for travelers, you know, people, workmen, sailors, people coming through. And so I think in my Waterville episode, I talk about, I forget the actual numbers, but it was like something like no police, 90 brothels, like 100 bars, like within a couple mile radius. It was just like, you know, people, the woman story that I told, she delved into the history a lot. And she talked about how, like, for sure there had to have been, you know, fights and murders and bodies dumped in the river, and none would have been the wiser because there wasn't any infrastructure at the time. So when I think of Waterford and Waterville, I really think of that area as just supercharged, especially because of the water there. And so I have a lot of personal stories that I definitely wanted to delve into. So the first one is submitted by Adam. I brought my kids to the park on Mallard's Landing over the summer. While my wife was watching the kids, I walked my dog around the land. He howled and ran away from the wood line to my wife. He was so fast, he almost ripped my arm off. I went to see what made him scurry so fast, and I saw a figure twice my size a few yards away. That moment I saw it, I felt what I could only describe as depression. I couldn't tell for sure what I saw, so I turned on my phone flashlight and I saw the figure clear as a bell. It was the darkest thing I've ever seen. It had endlessly deep glowing eyes and lanky limbs that looked like branches. It looked like a large skinny human with no depth other than eyes, which looked as if they went on forever. I felt more fear than I ever had in my entire life, and I ran as fast as I could. I grabbed my daughter and told my wife we needed to leave and grab my son and the dog. The kids were horrified, and my wife didn't believe me. She and I later went back to look and found nothing. Every time I go near that park, I feel ill and depressed. So the story from the Waterville kind of, you know, ties to that to a degree. So there was a sighting that I, you know, at a current business there that describes something similar. And I've heard that exact description of a being before on many different things, like podcasts, haunted podcasts, TV shows, paranormal TV shows. So I definitely am terrified of that description. The next one is submitted by Tiffany. In 2014, my ex-fiancé and I rented a studio apartment in Waterford. Right away, we were drawn to the historical value of the area, and we were content to rent in such an amazing place. However, it wasn't as peaceful as we thought. Not 2 days after we moved in, we started hearing child's voices throughout the small space. The source seemed to have been that of two small children, a young girl and boy who seemed to be about 8 years old. They had a habit of pulling pranks and were constantly moving my belongings around. While the boy tended to stay hidden, the girl often sat and watched me for hours. Both my ex-fiancé and I witnessed a woman that looked like nurse's wear from the Revolutionary War. To him, the woman appeared dark and dirty, her hair snarled and her eyes whited out, with a paper mache-like face. He also said she was very old looking and, in just one word, evil. However, when I saw her, she was very clean and friendly. She looked closer to my own age at the time. At first, we thought she was the extent of the paranormal occurrences, and while somewhat concerned, we remained in the apartment. As time passed, however, I began to feel more irritable and was prone to verbally violent outbursts over no reason. Almost 2 weeks later, there was a dark black mass huddled in the corner by my bathroom. Oh God. I was sitting on the couch and my fiance was getting ready for his night shift when I was overpowered by what I can say was a vast emptiness. I felt like I was being strangled. I refused to sleep that night until the four corners of my bed were protected by one of many crosses or Christian paraphernalia. As my fiancé left the building that night, a loud male voice yelled, "She's mine," and all the lights I had on went out. What? Creeped out, I asked a friend to do a cleansing, but that only seemed to make matters worse. She still stayed in the house that night, I would have gone running out. A large blackbird-like thing would perch itself in the corner of the kitchen ceiling. Oh my God, where I would stare at it for what my fiancé said would be hours at a time with no memory of doing so. This is terrifying. Once I felt a compulsion to touch it, and when he pulled me back, a small red dog started yelping at my feet. It led me to the bathroom, which at the time was the only dark room in the house, and tried to get me to follow it inside to play. Now I have a love of animals, and of course, being me, was about to go in when my fiancé again pulled me back. This time, whatever was in the house wasn't happy, and I was pulled to the ground, my leg covered in claw marks. When we moved to the other half of the studio, what looked like a large black mass with long arms and claws crawled across the floor where I had been pulled down. I have repeated goosebumps right now and chills. After that night, I refused to sleep in the house alone and had, by all accounts of all who knew me, had become more anxious and angry, lashing out all the time. According to my fiancé, three nights later, I was sitting and staring at what he dubbed the bird cage when I turned and attacked him, screaming that he had to leave, that he wasn't allowed to be there. When I calmed down, I was told that I laughed, but it wasn't my regular laugh. He said that I told him I belonged there and he can't take me. He said that if I tried, then I would die and he would be blamed. I was aware at the time that he had been looking for other apartments. I was unaware. Afraid for me and my safety, my fiancé brought a mutual friend and well-practiced Wiccan into the house. While she entered the main space and other vacant apartments, there was no issue. She refused to enter the one we were renting for more than a few minutes, and never in the dark. Another friend had come to visit after work with his new pit bull puppy. The animal was playing with us on the bed when it stopped and looked at the corner of the kitchen where the bathroom was and started growling. After a few seconds of all of this, it let out a loud yelp and seemed to fly across the bed, hitting the wall with some considerable force. My friend left and told me he wasn't going to visit again. Even after all this, I could not let the place go. I had fallen in love with the charm and became blind to the attacks in a way. The last night I spent there was in August. I had just lost my job and was depressed. I had gone to bed early but woke up about 1 a.m. with a feeling of something grabbing my legs. When I opened my eyes, the black mass was staring at me. It had long pointed teeth and eerie looking pale eyes. They were the only features I could make out. The next morning I packed all my things and moved out. I had lived there under 6 months. Okay, I have repeated chills and shivers and goosebumps running down my body. Again, go listen to the Water Valide episode. What happened in that apartment that Jill Marie Morris, the psychic medium, talks about. This is the stuff. I can handle pretty much everything. I am a fraidy cat and I let my mind run away with me, but I can pretty much handle most everything. But these are the descriptions of the exact kind of things where you're kinetically seeing and feeling things, but then black masses with long, lanky arms, with long fingers, and hanging out in dark corners of your apartment, but making themselves visible and physically interacting with you. Terrify me. The next one is submitted by Anonymous. I've lived in Waterford for a long time. My house is older than the Civil War. Every tenant that I've ever had says my place is haunted, and I agree with them all, but it's just a long history of good people. I've seen them and are proud of them. That's beautiful. That's a really nice way to contradict that other submission we just listened to. The next one is submitted by D. Waterford has a lot of activity. There is no question my house on Fonda Road is haunted. I did not believe until I lived there. We find some humor in it and has never been dangerous or harmful. Our house was built in the 1950s. In the fields behind us, there is a barn from the late 1700s and a house from the 1800s. There's not enough room to explain the past 6 years here. We still live in the house and we don't plan on moving. Oh, Dee, please tell us your stories. Write in. Tell them. The next one is submitted by Hunter. In my house, which is at least 40 years old, there is a handprint about 11 inches from tip to palm we painted over, and it continues to come back. Oh, 11 inches. That is terrifying. And the last story is from Sandy. So Sandy's is kind of lengthy. My friends lived in an old house that was converted to apartments across from the GE plant in Waterford, New York. It was rather run down, a large old Georgian style home with headstones in the yard and the creepy shadowy corners and interesting architecture. In all four corners of the living room, there were sculptures of cherubs with round light bulbs in their mouth. About a week after they moved in, they started telling us how they experienced some very scary paranormal activity. They saw shadows running after each other around gravestones in the yard. They were woken up to blood-curdling screams in the middle of the night. Rooms would turn ice cold in the middle of summer. I had the strangest feeling someone was in the bathroom with me, looking at me. One night, they had a big party. I was sitting in the kitchen in the front of a big old cast iron stove. I leaned back and rested my head on the stove and was momentarily sucked into another dimension. When I came out of it, everyone was dead quiet, asking me if I was okay. Apparently, I was white as a ghost. I was freezing, though it was about 100 degrees in the unair-conditioned apartment. I felt extremely compelled to tell everyone at the party that they had to leave the house immediately. My friend who lived there was asking me if I was all right and what did I take, if anything. I had a couple of beers, but that was it. I was out of my mind. I didn't want to be touched and didn't want to talk to everyone. I just needed to tell everyone to get out, and then literally ran outside and got a ride home with whoever was leaving at that time. A couple weeks later, they moved out of the house. I'm from Clifton Park, but my friends from Waterford told me later that they had also known people who had lived there and abruptly moved out after experiencing the same things, and that it was well known around Waterford as a haunted house. If anyone knows if that house is still there and has any more stories about the house or knows the address, please comment on this post. It's been about 20 years, but I still have flashbacks and nightmares about that night and would really like to know the history of the home. And there's actually two people that have followed up, and one's from Stephanie, and she says, about the old Georgian-style home in Waterford across from the old GE. I believe I have the address and picture of the house. My grandfather still lives across the street, and I live up the road, and my house is quote-unquote, active. And then someone named Deneen said, this isn't the last one, actually said, hi, Stephanie, I belong to a very small local paranormal group, and we would be interested in touring the house. And then I believe this one is actually the last one, and it is submitted by Jessica. One day I was driving my car when I saw a little girl weeping on the side of the road just outside of town. Nobody else on the road seemed to have noticed her because they kept on driving. I pulled over to help her, but when she saw my car, she disappeared. About 2 weeks later, I drove down the same road and saw her again. This time when I pulled over, she didn't disappear. I walked over to her and asked what seemed to be wrong. She told me she ran away from home to escape her violent father. She was scared that he was looking for her. Just then a man pulled over. The little girl, whose name was Mary, disappeared. The man asked me if I was okay. Then I noticed that I was the only one who could see her. Ever since then, I've been going down that road, and every time she's still there, but I just keep driving. That's fascinating. And then next and lastly, we're just going to bounce over to Scaticoke for some personal stories and then just a few fun things that happen in that area. So this is submitted by Noyona. Me and my friends were at the school playing basketball. We thought we saw something walk by, and we looked around and nothing was there. We continued playing and heard a little girl asking our names. Her face was covered in blood, and she was in a pink dress with blonde hair. She then went to the swings talking to herself. So we just asked how she got killed, and she said it wasn't my fault. She said her name really quietly, and it sounded like Valerie or Maria. We got freaked out and ran to the car, and my grandpa asked what was wrong, and we told him, but he said he didn't see anyone on the playground but us. The next one is submitted by Emily. Me and my friend were outside walking our dog. She had to go out to do her business. We were taking photos, and then after we had come inside, there was a gold strip on a photo. There have been multiple sightings of ghosts at my house, and I've heard loud bangings and noises coming down the stairs when home alone, and cupboards banging. But we built our house, so I really don't know what to think. And people know a new house doesn't necessarily mean that it's not haunted. The next one is submitted by Kristen. I lived in Melrose since 1995. I saw ghosts every night. I've never been so scared. Men, women, children, ghosts, I had multiple. The lady was nice. The children were noisy and quick to disappear, and I get chills just thinking about it. I tried to blow it off as my imagination, and they would play tricks on me, turning on and off TV lights, and I'm so glad that I don't live there. I hate them damned ghosts. They made my life miserable for a year. Thank God I rented at that time. Trust me, they are real. And lastly, but one submitted by John, the Knickerbocker Mansion. I was driving by it and saw a tan man running after my car with an axe. Screaming, I took off, but I would never drive on that road again. And my brother also thought he saw a soldier dressed in red, like a British colonel or something, walking down the road. Oh my goodness. I do love the personal stories. So please send your stories in. I really, really enjoy it. And then just a few other quick things about Scaticoke. At the Knickerbocker Mansion, that was a really beautiful personal story to round this out, because I didn't even know about this place. It's called the Knickerbocker Mansion in Scaticoke. And they did a retelling from ghostly characters, the event at the Knickerbocker Mansion in 2021. So I'm wondering if they'll do it again, but... just a little bit of information. As you know, our area is steeped in history. In the early 1700s, and a family settled into Scaticoke known as the Knickerbockers. There are many stories surrounding the family, and this weekend, one of the most gruesome tales will be told by ghostly characters. The Knickerbocker Mansion is in Scaticoke will host this chilling event about the Kettley Hun Massacre. The history of the mansion. They owned the property for nearly 250 years. They acquired the property in 1707. In 1770, the son of Colonel John Knickerbocker III, built the mansion where he lived with his wife and 14 children. Only 11 of them made it to adulthood. There were 102 grandchildren that came from the Knickerbocker family. The mansion was acquired by the Knickerbocker Historical Society, where it is now a museum. And back in 2012 and 2013, renovations were done that restored the fireplaces and some of the interior of the mansion. The annual Nick at Night Super Supper was held this year, and it included a candlelight guided tour of the Knickerbocker Mansion, where guests were transported to 1711, where Anna Quackenbush Knickerbocker and ghostly characters told the story of the Kettley Hun Massacre. So I just thought that's a really interesting, thing that happened. And I'm wondering if that is still happening. And I actually just did a quick search to see if I could find some information about this massacre, and I'm having trouble. It's spelled K-E-T-T-E-L-H-U-Y-N, Kettley Hun Massacre. So I'm curious what that actually is about. So listeners, if any of you know, please write in. I would love to know. And last but not least, I just wanted to mention, I think, something that most people in the area know about, which is nightmares at Liberty Ridge Farm. Its claim to fame is it's the Capital Region's most terrifying haunted house and mazes. There's a lot of really great ones around. I've never been to this one because I actually thought it was more for like younger children, but the photograph on the website looks terrifying. So I'm curious if it's good for... definitely is geared towards adults, so I'm curious if it would be good things for me to go to, so I'll definitely check it out. It includes the Farmer's Haunted House, the Field of Screams, an underground tunnel, The Forest of Fear, and the 3D Macomb Manor. So lots to look at. So definitely Nightmares at Liberty Ridge Farm. I actually drive by that on my way to my studio every time I go. So I always wonder about it. So that is it, friends. That was so much more to talk about than I ever thought from these little areas, especially where I'm currently, currently hanging out. And I just wanted to give credit where credit's due. One of my favorite books that I own is Saratoga County Ghosts by the author David J. Pitkin. And I have an autographed copy that I just happened upon. I thrifted it. And so it's very special to me. So a lot of the stories that we talked about today were from that book. And if you don't know who David J. Pitkin is, and I actually dedicated a full episode to him called Remembering David J. Pitkin, definitely go back and hear his story. And then, as always, I want to give credit where credit's due. So ghostsofamerica.com, always such a great resource. NewYorkHauntedHouses.com, WGNA, New Country Albany, also known as 107.7 GNA, and the Knickerbocker Mansion website, as well as Liberty Ridge Farms website. So on that note, longer episode that I've done in a while, and so I really hope you enjoyed this little tour. The last thing I just wanted to reiterate was just how in all my time doing this, and I've explored and researched a good portion, if not the better portion, of the 518 at this point. And I still think that Waterford and Watervliet is the scariest, spookiest, most sinister area. There's a lot of inhabitants, spectral inhabitants across this area and beyond, but that really truly seems to be I've never heard any other reportings of these dark, slender, tall, disgusting looking, sinister looking creatures, shadow creatures. I've also not really heard anything as violent as these creatures tend to be. And again, my Waterford episode delves into that a lot. So I absolutely recommend checking out the area if you're sensitive, but tread lightly. And please, 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 listeners, if you live in that area and have stories, I would love to hear them. So on that note, I hope you enjoyed our little tour starting in Malta and then dipping down into the Waterford area, but they were close enough and I wanted to make sure we talked about all of it. So a big cheers to everyone, and as always, happy haunting.